Good for you. You'd look like a cream puff, like that lady there.
And did you see those shoes?
What? Those are shoes? We went as far as Palazzo Telamari, laughing and joking. Pasquale, who did his best to avoid being next to Lila, and when she took his arm, immediately, politely freed himself. He spoke to her often, of course. He felt an evident pleasure in hearing her voice, in looking at her, but it was clear that the slightest contact overwhelmed him, might even make him cry. Staying close to me, asked derisively,
At school, do your classmates look like that?
No.
That means it's not a good school.
It's a classical high school, I said, offended.
It's not a good one,
he insisted.
You can be sure that if there are no people like that, it's no good. Right, Lila? It's no good.
Good? Lila said, and pointed to a blonde girl who was coming toward us with a tall, dark young man in a white V-neck sweater. If there's no one like that, your school stinks. And she burst out laughing. The girl was all in green. Green shoes, green skirt, green jacket. And on her head, this was above all what made Lila laugh, she wore a bowler, like Charlie Chaplin, also green. The hilarity passed from her to the rest of us. When the couple went by, Reno made a vulgar comment on what the young woman in green should do with the bowler hat. And Pasquale stopped. He was laughing so hard, and leaned against the wall with one arm. The girl and her companion took a few steps, then stopped. The boy in the white pullover turned, was immediately restrained by the girl who grabbed his arm. He wriggled free, came back, addressed directly to Reno a series of insulting phrases. It was an instant. Reno punched him in the face and knocked him down, shouting, What did you call me?
I didn't get it. Repeat. What did you call me? Did you hear, Pasca? What he called me?
Our laughter abruptly turned to fear. Lila first of all hurled herself at her brother before he started kicking the young man on the ground and dragged him off with an expression of disbelief, as if a thousand fragments of our life, from childhood to this, our 14th year, were composing an image that was finally clear, yet which at that moment seemed to her incredible. We pushed Reno and Pasquale away, while the girl in the bowler helped her boyfriend get up. Lila's incredulity, meanwhile, was changing into fury. As she tried to get her brother off, she assailed him with the coarsest insults, pulled him by the arm, threatened him. Reno kept her away with one hand, a nervous laugh on his face, and meanwhile he turned to Pasquale.
My sister thinks this is a game, Pasca,
he said in dialect, his eyes wild.
My sister thinks that even if I say it's better for us not to go somewhere, she can do it, because she always knows everything. She always understands everything, as usual. And she can go there, like it or not.
A short pause to regain his breath. Then he added,
Did you hear that shit called me hick? Me, a hick? A hick?
And still, breathless.
My sister brought me here, and now she sees if I'm called a hick. Now she sees what I do if they call me a hick.
Calm down, Reno, Pasquale said, looking behind him every so often in alarm. Reno remained agitated, but subdued. Lila, however, had calmed down. We stopped at Piazza dei Martiri. Pasquale said, almost coldly, addressing Carmela,
You girls go home now.
Alone?
Yes.
No.
Carme, I don't want to discuss it. Go.
We don't know how to get there.
Don't lie. Go,
Reno said to Lila, trying to contain himself.
Take some money. Buy an ice cream on the way. We left together, and we're going back together.
Rena lost patience again, gave her a shove.
Will you stop it? I'm older, and you do what I tell you. Move. Go. In a second, I'll bash your face in.
I saw that he was ready to do it, seriously. I dragged Leela by the arm. But she also understood the risk. I'll tell Papa.
Who gives a fuck? Walk. Come on, go. You don't even deserve the ice cream.
Hesitantly, we went up past Santa Caterina. But after a while, Leela had second thoughts, stopped, said that she was going back to her brother. We tried to persuade her to stay with us, but she wouldn't listen. Just then, we saw a group of boys, 5, maybe 6. They looked like the rowers we had sometimes admired on Sunday walks near Castel dell'Ovo. They were all tall, sturdy, well-dressed. Some had sticks, some didn't. They quickly passed by the church and headed toward the piazza. Among them was the young man whom Marino had struck in the face. His V-necked sweater was stained with blood. Leela freed herself from my grip and ran off, Carmela and I behind her. We arrived in time to see Reno and Pasquale backing up toward the monument at the center of the piazza, side by side, while those well-dressed youths chased them, hitting them with their sticks. We called for help. We began to cry, to stop people passing. But the sticks were frightening. No one helped. Leela grabbed the arm of one of the attackers, but was thrown to the ground. I saw Pasquale on his knees, being kicked. I saw Reno protecting himself from the blows with his arm. Then a car stopped, and it was the Soldados 1100. Marcello got out immediately. First he helped Leela up, and then, incited by her, as she shrieked with rage and shouted at her brother, threw himself into the fight, hitting and getting hit. Only at that point Michele got out of the car, opened the trunk in a leisurely way, took out something that looked like a shiny iron bar, and joined in, hitting with a cold ferocity that I hope never to see again in my life. Reno and Pasquale got up furiously, hitting, choking, tearing. They seemed like strangers. They were so transformed by hatred. The well-dressed young men were routed. Michele went up to Pasquale, whose nose was bleeding, but Pasquale rudely pushed him away and wiped his face with the sleeve of his white shirt, then saw that it was soaked red. Marcello picked up a bunch of keys and handed it to Reno, who thanked him uneasily. The people who had kept their distance before now came over, curious. I was paralyzed with fear.
Take the girls away, Reno said to the 2 Soldados, in the grateful tone of someone who makes a request that he knows is unavoidable. Marcello made us get in the car, first Leela, who resisted. We were all jammed in the back seat, sitting on each other's knees. I turned to look at Pasquale and Reno, who were heading toward the Riviera, Pasquale limping. I felt as if our neighborhood had expanded, swallowing all Naples, even the streets where respectable people lived. In the car, there were immediate tensions. Giliola and Ada were annoyed, protesting that the ride was uncomfortable. It's impossible, they said. Then get out and walk, Leela shouted, and they were about to start hitting each other. Marcello braked, amused. Giliola got out and went to sit in front, on Michele's knees. We made the journey like that, with Giliola and Michele kissing each other in front of us. I looked at her, and she, though kissing passionately, looked at me. I turned away. Leela said nothing until we reached the neighborhood. Marcello said a few words, his eyes looking for her in the rearview mirror, but she never responded. They let us out far from our houses so that we wouldn't be seen in the Salada's car. The rest of the way we walked, the five of us. Apart from Leela, who seemed consumed by anger and worry, we all admired the behavior of the two brothers. Good for them, we said. They behaved well. Giliola kept repeating, "Of course. What did you think? Naturally." With the air of one who, working in the pastry shop, knew very well what first-rate people the Saladas were. At one point she asked me, but in a teasing tone, "How's school?" "Great. But you don't have fun the way I do." "It's a different type of fun." When she, Carmela, and Ada left us at the entrance of their building, I said to Leela, "The rich people certainly are worse than we are." She didn't answer. I added cautiously, "The Saladas may be shit, but it's lucky they were there. Those people on Via dei Mille might have killed Rino and Pasquale." She shook her head energetically. She was paler than usual, and under her eyes were deep purple hollows. She didn't agree, but she didn't tell me why.
27. I was promoted with nines in all my subjects. I would even receive something called a scholarship. Of the 40 we had been, 32 remained. Gino failed. Alfonso had to retake the exams in 3 subjects in September. Urged by my father, I went to see Maestra Oliviero. My mother was against it. She didn't like the teacher to interfere in her family and claim the right to make decisions about her children in her place. With the usual 2 packets, one of sugar and one of coffee, bought at the bar Salada to thank her for her interest in me. She wasn't feeling well. She had something in her throat that hurt her. But she was full of praise, congratulated me on how hard I had worked, said that I looked a little too pale, and that she intended to telephone a cousin who lived on Ischia to see if she would let me stay with her for a little while. I thanked her, but said nothing to my mother of that possibility. I already knew that she wouldn't let me go. Me on Ischia? Me alone on the ferry traveling over the sea? Not to mention me on the beach, swimming? In a bathing suit? I didn't even mention it to Leela. Her life in a few months had lost even the adventurous aura associated with the shoe factory. And I didn't want to boast about the promotion, the scholarship, a possible vacation in Ischia. In appearance, things had improved. Marcello Salada had stopped following her. But after the violence in Piazza dei Martiri, something completely unexpected happened that puzzled her. He came to the shop to ask about Rino's condition, and the honor conferred by that visit perturbed Fernando. But Rino, who had been careful not to tell his father what had happened, to explain the bruises on his face and his body, he made up a story that he had fallen off a friend's Lambretta, and worried that Marcello might say one word too many, had immediately steered him out into the street. They had taken a short walk. Rino had reluctantly thanked Salada both for his intervention and for the kindness of coming to see how he was. 2 minutes, and they had said goodbye. When he returned to the shop, his father had said, "Finally, you're doing something good." "What?" "A friendship with Marcello Salada." "There's no friendship, Papa." "Then it means you are a fool, and a fool you remain." Fernando wanted to say something was changing, and that his son, whatever he wanted to call that thing with the Saladas, would do well to encourage it. He was right. Marcello returned a couple of days later with his grandfather's shoes to resole. Then he invited Rino to go for a drive. Then he urged him to apply for a license, assuming the responsibility for getting him to practice in the 1100. Maybe it wasn't friendship, but the Salatas certainly had taken a liking to Reno.
When Leela, ignorant of these visits, which took place entirely at the shoemaker's shop, where she never went, heard about them, she, unlike her father, felt an increasing worry. First, she remembered the Battle of the Fireworks and thought, Reno hates the Salatas too much. It can't be that he'll let himself be taken in. Then she had had to observe that Marcello's attentions were seducing her older brother even more than her parents. She now knew Reno's fragility, but still she was angry at the way the Salatas were getting into his head, making him a kind of happy little monkey.
"What's wrong with it?" I objected once. "They're dangerous. Here, everything is dangerous.
Did you see what Michele took out of the car in Piazza dei Martiri?"
"No."
"An iron bar. The others had sticks." "You don't see it, Lenu, but the bar was sharpened into a point. If he wanted, he could have thrust it into the chest or the stomach of one of those guys."
"Well, you threatened Marcello with the shoemaker's knife." At that point, she grew irritated and said I didn't understand. And probably it was true. It was her brother, not mine. I liked to be logical, while she had different needs. She wanted to get Reno away from that relationship. But as soon as she made some critical remark, Reno shut her up, threatened her, sometimes beat her. And so things, willy-nilly, proceeded to the point where, one evening in late June, I was at Leela's house, I was helping her fold sheets or something, I don't remember. The door opened, and Reno entered, followed by Marcello. He had invited Solara to dinner, and Fernando, who had just returned from the shop, very tired, at first was irritated, and then felt honored and behaved cordially, not to mention Nunzia. She became agitated, thanked Marcello for the 3 bottles of good wine that he had brought, pulled the other children into the kitchen so they wouldn't be disruptive. I myself was involved with Leela in the preparations for dinner. "I'll put roach poison in it," Leela said, furious at the stove. And we laughed while Nunzia shut us up. "He's come to marry you," I said to provoke her. "He's going to ask your father."
"He is deceiving himself."
"Why?" Nunzia asked anxiously.
"If he likes you, do you say no?"
"Ma, I already told him no."
"Really?"
"Yes."
"What are you saying?"
"It's true," I said in confirmation.
"Your father must never know, otherwise he'll kill you."
At dinner, only Marcello spoke. It was clear that he had invited himself, and Reno, who didn't know how to say no to him, sat at the table nearly silent, or laughed for no reason. Solara addressed himself mainly to Fernando, but never neglected to pour water or wine for Nunzia, for Leela, for me. He said to him how much he was respected in the neighborhood because he was such a good cobbler. He said that his father had always spoken well of his skill. He said that Reno had an unlimited admiration for his abilities as a shoemaker. Fernando, partly because of the wine, was moved. He muttered something in praise of Silvio Solara, and he even went so far as to say that Reno was a good worker and was becoming a good shoemaker. Then Marcello started to praise the need for progress. He said that his grandfather had started with a cellar, then his father had enlarged it, and today the bar pastry shop Salata was what it was. Everybody knew it. People came from all over Naples to have coffee, eat a pastry.
"What an exaggeration," Lilo exclaimed,
and her father gave her a silencing look.
But Marcello smiled at her humbly and admitted,
"Yes, maybe I'm exaggerating a little,
But just to say that money has to circulate. You begin with a seller, and from generation to generation you can go far. At this point, with Reno showing evident signs of uneasiness, he began to praise the idea of making new shoes. And from that moment he began to look at Leela as if in praising the energy of the generations, he were praising her in particular. He said, "If someone feels capable, if he's clever, if he can invent good things which are pleasing, why not try?" He spoke in a nice, charming dialect, and as he spoke, he never stopped staring at my friend. I saw that he was in love, as in the songs, that he would have liked to kiss her, that he wanted to breathe her breath, that she would be able to make of him all she wanted, that in his eyes she embodied all possible feminine qualities. "I know," Marcello concluded, "that your children made a very nice pair of shoes, size 43, just my size." A long silence fell. Reno stared at his plate and didn't dare look up at his father. Only the sound of the goldfinch at the window could be heard. Fernando said slowly, "Yes, they're size 43. I would very much like to see them, if you don't mind." Fernando stammered, "I don't know where they are. Nunzia, do you know?" "She has them," Reno said, indicating his sister. "I did have them, yes. I had put them in the storeroom, but then Mama told me to clean it out the other day, and I threw them away, since no one liked them." Reno said angrily, "You're a liar. Go and get the shoes right now." Fernando said nervously, "Go get the shoes. Go on." Leela burst out, addressing her father. "How is it that now you want them? I threw them away because you said you didn't like them." Fernando pounded the table with his open hand. The wine trembled in the glasses. "Get up and go get the shoes, right now." Leela pushed away her chair, stood up. "I threw them away," she repeated weakly, and left the room. She didn't come back. The time passed in silence. The first to become alarmed was Marcello. He said, with real concern, "Maybe I was wrong. I didn't know that there were problems." "There's no problem," Fernando said, and whispered to his wife, "Go see what your daughter is doing." Nunzia left the room. When she came back, she was embarrassed. She couldn't find Leela. We looked for her all over the house. She wasn't there. We called her from the window. Nothing. Marcello, desolate, took his leave. As soon as he had gone, Fernando shouted at his wife, "God's truth, this time I'm going to kill your daughter." Reno joined his father in the threat. Nunzia began to cry. I left almost on tiptoe, frightened. But as soon as I closed the door and came out on the landing, Leela called me. She was on the top floor. I went up on tiptoe. She was huddled next to the door to the terrace, in the shadows. She had the shoes in her lap. For the first time I saw them finished. They shone in the feeble light of a bulb hanging on an electrical cable. "What would it cost you to let him see them?" I asked, confused. She shook her head energetically. "I don't even want him to touch them." But she was as if overwhelmed by her own extreme reaction. Her lower lip trembled, something that never happened. Gradually, I persuaded her to go home. She couldn't stay hiding there forever. I went with her, counting on the fact that my presence would protect her. But there were shouts, insults, some blows just the same. Fernando screamed that on a whim she had made him look foolish in the eyes of an important guest. Reno tore the shoes out of her hand, saying that they were his. The work had been done by him. She began to cry, murmuring, "I worked on them too, but it would have been better if I'd never done it.
You've become a mad beast.
It was Nunzia who put an end to that torture. She turned pale, and in a voice that was not her usual voice, she ordered her children, and even her husband, she who was always so submissive, to stop it immediately, to give the shoes to her, not to venture a single word if they didn't want her to jump out the window. Reno gave her the shoes, and for the moment things ended there. I slipped away. 28. But Reno wouldn't give in, and in the following days, he continued to attack his sister with words and fists. Every time Leela and I met, I saw a new bruise. After a while, I felt that she was resigned. One morning, he insisted that they go out together, that she come with him to the shoemaker's shop. On the way, they both sought, with wavy moves, to end the war. Reno said that he loved her, but that she didn't love anyone, neither her parents nor her siblings. Leela murmured, "What do you mean by love? What does love mean for our family? Let's hear." Step by step, he revealed to her what he had in mind.
"If Marcello likes the shoes, Papa will change his mind."
"I don't think so."
"Yes, he will. And if Marcello buys them, Papa will understand that your designs are good, that they're profitable, and he'll have us start work."
"The three of us?"
"He and I, and maybe you too. Papa is capable of making a pair of shoes completely finished in 4 days, at most 5. And I, if I work hard, I'll show you that I can do the same. We make them, we sell them, and we finance ourselves."
"Who do we sell them to? Always Marcello Solara?"
"The Solaras market them. They know people who count. They'll do the publicity for us."
"They'll do it for free?"
"If they want a small percentage, we'll give it to them."
"And why should they be content with a small percentage?"
"They've taken a liking to me."
"The Solaras?"
"Yes."
Leela sighed. "Just one thing. I'll tell Papa and see what he thinks."
"Don't you dare."
"This way, or not at all." Reno was silent, very nervous.
"All right. Anyway, you speak. You can speak better."
That evening, at dinner, in front of her brother, whose face was fiery red, Leela said to Fernando that Marcello not only had shown great curiosity about the shoe enterprise, but might even be interested in buying the shoes for himself, and that, in fact, if he was enthusiastic about the matter from a commercial point of view, he would advertise the product in the circles he frequented, in exchange, naturally, for a small percentage of the sales.
"This," I said, Reno explained with lowered eyes, "not Marcello."
Fernando looked at his wife. Leela understood that they had talked about it and had already, secretly, reached a conclusion.
"Tomorrow," he said, "I'll put your shoes in the shop window. If someone wants to see them, wants to try them, wants to buy them, whatever fucking thing, he has to talk to me. I am the one who decides."
A few days later, I passed by the shop. Reno was working. Fernando was working, both heads bent over the work. I saw in the window, among boxes of shoe polish and laces, the beautiful, elegant shoes made by the Cerullos. A sign pasted to the window, certainly written by Reno, said pompously, "Shoes handmade by the Cerullos here." Father and son waited for good luck to arrive. But Leela was skeptical, sulky. She had no faith in the ingenuous hypothesis of her brother, and was afraid of the indecipherable agreement between her father and mother. In other words, she expected bad things. A week passed, and no one showed the least interest in the shoes in the window, not even Marcello.
Only because he was cornered by Reno, in fact almost dragged to the shop, did Salada glance at them, but as if he had other things on his mind. He tried them, of course, but said they were a little tight, took them off immediately, and disappeared without even a word of compliment, as if he had a stomachache and had to hurry home. Disappointment of father and son. But 2 minutes later, Marcello reappeared. Reno jumped up, beaming, and took his hand as if some agreement by that pure and simple reappearance had already been made. But Marcello ignored him and turned directly to Fernando. He said, all in one breath, I have very serious intentions, Don Fernan. I would like the hand of your daughter, Lina. 29. Reno reacted to that turn with a violent fever that kept him away from work for days. When, abruptly, the fever went down, he had disturbing symptoms. He got out of bed in the middle of the night, and while still sleeping, silent and extremely agitated, he went to the door and struggled to open it, with his eyes wide open. Nunzia and Lila, frightened, dragged him back to bed. Fernando, however, who with his wife had immediately guessed Marcello's true intentions, spoke with his daughter calmly. He explained to her that Marcello Salata's proposal was important not only for her future, but for that of the whole family. He told her that she was still a child and didn't have to say yes immediately, but added that he, as her father, advised her to consent. A long engagement at home would slowly get her used to the marriage. Lila answered with equal tranquility that rather than be engaged to Marcello Salata and marry him, she would go and drown herself in the pond. A great quarrel arose, but she didn't change her mind. I was stunned by the news. I knew that Marcello wanted to be Lila's boyfriend at all costs, but it would never have entered my mind that at our age one could receive a proposal of marriage. And yet Lila had received one, and she wasn't yet 15. She hadn't yet had a secret boyfriend, had never kissed anyone. I sided with her immediately. Get married? To Marcello Salata? Maybe even have children? No, absolutely no. I encouraged her to fight that new war against her father and swore I would support her, even if he had already lost his composure and now was threatening her, saying that for her own good he would break every bone in her body if she didn't accept a proposal of that importance. But I couldn't stay with her. In the middle of July, something happened that I should have thought of, but that instead caught me unawares and overwhelmed me. One late afternoon, after the usual walk through the neighborhood with Lila, discussing what was happening to her and how to get out of it, I came home, and my sister Elisa opened the door. She said in a state of excitement that in the dining room was her teacher, that is, Maestra Oliviero. She was talking to our mother. I looked timidly into the room. My mother stammered in annoyance, Maestra Oliviero says you need to rest. You're worn out. I looked at the teacher without understanding. She seemed the one in need of rest. She was pale, and her face was puffy. She said to me, my cousin responded just yesterday. You can go to her in Ischia and stay there until the end of August. She'll be happy to have you. You just have to help a little in the house. She spoke to me as if she were my mother, and as if my mother, the real one, with the injured leg and the wandering eye, were only a disposable living being, and as such not to be taken into consideration. Nor did she go away after that communication, but stayed another hour, showing me one by one the books that she had brought to lend me. She explained to me which I should read first and which after. She made me swear that before reading them,
I would make covers for them. She ordered me to give them all back at the end of the summer without a single dog ear. My mother endured all this patiently. She sat attentively, even though her wandering eye gave her a dazed expression. She exploded only when the teacher finally took her leave, with a disdainful farewell, and not even a caress for my sister, who had counted on it and would have been proud. She turned to me, overwhelmed by bitterness for the humiliation that it seemed to her she had suffered on my account. She said, "The signorina must go and rest on Ischia. The signorina is too exhausted. Go and make dinner. Go on, or I'll hit you." 2 days later, however, after taking my measurements and rapidly making me a bathing suit, I don't know where she copied it from, she herself took me to the ferry. Along the street to the port, while she bought me the ticket, and then, while she waited for me to get on, she besieged me with warnings. What frightened her most was the crossing. "Let's hope the sea isn't rough," she said almost to herself, and swore that when I was a child, she had taken me to Coroglio every day, so my catarrh would dry out, and that the sea was beautiful, and I had learned to swim. But I didn't remember Coroglio, or the sea, or learning to swim, and I told her. And her tone became resentful, as if to say that if I drowned, it would not be her fault, that what she was supposed to do to avoid it she had done, but because of my own forgetfulness. Then she ordered me not to go far from the shore, even when the sea was calm, and to stay home if it was rough or there was a red flag. "Especially," she said, "if you have a full stomach or your period, you mustn't even get your feet wet." Before she left, she asked an old sailor to keep an eye on me. When the ferry left the wharf, I was terrified, and at the same time, happy. For the first time, I was leaving home. I was going on a journey by sea. The large body of my mother, along with the neighborhood and Leela's troubles, grew distant and vanished. 30. I blossomed. The teacher's cousin was called Nella Incardo, and she lived in Barano. I arrived in the town by bus and found the house easily. Nella was a big, kind woman, very lively, talkative, unmarried. She rented rooms to vacationers, keeping for herself one small room and the kitchen. I would sleep in the kitchen. I had to make up my bed in the evening and take it all apart, boards, legs, mattress, in the morning. I discovered that I had some mandatory obligations. To get up at 6:30, make breakfast for her and her guests. When I arrived, there was an English couple with two children. Tidy up and wash cups and bowls, set the table for dinner, and wash the dishes before going to sleep. Otherwise, I was free. I could sit on the terrace and read with the sea in front of me, or walk along a steep white road toward a long, wide, dark beach that was called Spiaggia dei Maronti. In the beginning, after all the fears that my mother had inoculated me with, and all the troubles I had with my body, I spent the time on the terrace, dressed, writing a letter to Leela every day, each one filled with questions, clever remarks, lively descriptions of the island. But one morning Nella made fun of me, saying, "What are you doing like this? Put on your bathing suit." When I put it on, she burst out laughing. She thought it was old-fashioned. She sewed me one that she said was more modern, very low over the bosom, more fitted around the bottom, of a beautiful blue. I tried it on, and she was enthusiastic. She said it was time I went to the sea. Enough of the terrace. The next day, amid 1,000 fears and 1,000 curiosities, I set out with a towel and a book toward the Maronti. The trip seemed very long. I met no one coming up or going down.
The beach was endless and deserted, with a granular sand that rustled at every step. The sea gave off an intense odor and a sharp, monotonous sound. I stood looking for a long time at that great mass of water. Then I sat on the towel, uncertain what to do. Finally, I got up and stuck my feet in. How had it happened that I lived in a city like Naples and never thought, not once, of swimming in the sea? And yet it was so. I advanced cautiously, letting the water rise from my feet to my ankles to my thighs. Then I missed a step and sank. Terrified, I gasped for air, swallowed water, returned to the surface, to the air. I realized that it came naturally to move my feet and arms in a certain way to keep myself afloat. So I knew how to swim. My mother really had taken me to the sea as a child. And there, while she took the sand treatments, I had learned to swim. I saw her in a flash, younger, less ravaged, sitting on the black sand in the midday sun, in a flowered white dress, her good leg covered to the knee by her dress, the injured one completely buried in the burning sand. The seawater and the sun rapidly erased the inflammation of the acne from my face. I burned, I darkened, I waited for letters from Leela. We had promised when we said goodbye, but none came. I practiced speaking English a little with the family at Nella's. They understood that I wanted to learn and spoke to me with increasing kindness, and I improved quite a lot. Nella, who was always cheerful, encouraged me, and I began to interpret for her. Meanwhile, she didn't miss any opportunity to compliment me. She made me enormous meals, and she was a really good cook. She said that I had been a stick when I arrived, and now, thanks to her treatment, I was beautiful. In other words, the last 10 days of July gave me a sense of well-being that I had never known before. I felt a sensation that later in my life was often repeated, the joy of the new. I liked everything, getting up early, making breakfast, tidying up, walking in Burano, taking the road to the Meronti, uphill and down, lying in the sun and reading, going for a swim, returning to my book. I did not feel homesick for my father, my brothers and sister, my mother, the streets of the neighborhood, the public gardens. I missed only Leela, Leela who didn't answer my letters. I was afraid of what was happening to her, good or bad, in my absence. It was an old fear, a fear that had never left me, the fear that, in losing pieces of her life, mine lost intensity and importance. And the fact that she didn't answer emphasized that preoccupation. However hard I tried in my letters to communicate the privilege of the days in Ischia, my river of words and her silence seemed to demonstrate that my life was splendid but uneventful, which left me time to write to her every day, while hers was dark but full. At the end of July, Nella told me that on the 1st of August, in place of the English, a Neapolitan family was to arrive. It was the second year they had come. Very respectable people, very polite, refined, especially the husband, a true gentleman who always said wonderful things to her. And then the older son, really a fine boy, tall, thin but strong. This year he was 17. "You won't be alone anymore," she said to me. And I was embarrassed, immediately filled with anxiety about this young man who was arriving. Fearful that we wouldn't be able to speak two words to each other, that he wouldn't like me. As soon as the English departed, they left me a couple of novels to practice my reading and their address so that if I ever decided to go to England, I should go and see them. Nella had me help her clean the rooms,
do the laundry, remake the beds. I was glad to do it, and as I was washing the floor, she called to me from the kitchen. "How clever you are. You can even read in English. Are the books you brought not enough?" And she went on praising me from a distance, in a loud voice, for how disciplined I was, how sensible, for how I read all day and also at night. When I joined her in the kitchen, I found her with a book in her hand. She said that the man who was arriving the next day had written it himself. Nella kept it on her night table. Every evening she read a poem, first to herself, and then aloud. Now she knew them all by heart. "Look what he wrote to me," she said, and handed me the book. It was Attempts at Serenity by Donato Saratori. The dedication read, "To darling Nella and to her jams." 31. I immediately wrote to Leela. Pages and pages of apprehension, joy, the wish to flee, intense foreshadowing of the moment when I would see Nino Saratore. I would walk to the Meronti with him. We would swim. We would look at the moon and the stars. We would sleep under the same roof. All I could think of was that intense moment when, holding his brother by the hand a century ago, ah, how much time had passed, he had declared his love. We were children then. Now I felt grown up, almost old. The next day, I went to the bus stop to help the guests carry their bags. I was very agitated. I hadn't slept all night. The bus arrived, stopped. The travelers got out. I recognized Donato Saratore. I recognized Lydia, his wife. I recognized Marisa, although she was very changed. I recognized Clelia, who was always by herself. I recognized little Pino, who was now a solemn kid. And I imagined that the capricious child who was annoying his mother must be the one who, the last time I had seen the entire Saratore family, was still in a carriage under the projectiles hurled by Melina. But I didn't see Nino. Marisa threw her arms around my neck with an enthusiasm I would never have expected. In all those years, I had never, absolutely never, thought of her. Well, she said she had often thought of me with great nostalgia. When she alluded to the days in the neighborhood and told her parents that I was the daughter of Greco, the porter, Lydia, her mother, made a grimace of distaste and hurried to grab her little child to scold him for something or other. Well, Donato Saratore saw to the luggage without even a remark like, "How is your father?" I felt depressed. The Saratores settled in their rooms, and I went to the sea with Marisa, who knew the Meronti and all Ischia well, and was already impatient. She wanted to go to the port, where there was more activity, and to Forio, and to Casamicciola, anywhere but Berano, which according to her was a morgue. She told me that she was studying to be a secretary, and had a boyfriend whom I would meet soon because he was coming to see her, but secretly. Finally, she told me something that tugged at my heart. She knew all about me. She knew that I went to the high school, that I was very clever, and that Gino, the pharmacist's son, was my boyfriend. "Who told you?" "My brother." So Nino had recognized me. So he knew who I was. So it was not inattention, but perhaps timidity. Perhaps uneasiness. Perhaps shame for the declaration he had made to me as a child. "I stopped going with Gino ages ago," I said. "Your brother isn't very well informed." "All he thinks about is studying. It's already a lot that he told me about you. Usually he's got his head in the clouds." "He's not coming?" "He'll come when Papa leaves." She spoke to me very critically about Nino. He had no feelings. He was never excited about anything. He didn't get angry, but he wasn't nice either. He was closed up in himself. All he cared about was studying.
He didn't like anything.
He was cold-blooded. The only person who managed to get him a little was his father. Not that they quarreled. He was a respectful and obedient son. But Marisa knew very well that Nino couldn't stand his father, whereas she adored him. He was the best and most intelligent man in the world.
Is your father staying long? When is he leaving? I asked her with perhaps excessive interest.
Just 3 days. He has to work.
And Nino arrives in 3 days?
Yes. He pretended that he had to help the family of a friend of his move.
And it's not true.
He doesn't have any friends. And anyway, he wouldn't carry that stone from here to there, even for my mama, the only person he loves, even a little. Imagine if he's going to help a friend. We went swimming. We dried off walking along the shore. Laughing, she pointed out to me something I had never noticed. At the end of the black beach were some motionless white forms. She dragged me, still laughing, over the burning sand. And at a certain point, it became clear that they were people, living people, covered with mud. It was some sort of treatment. We didn't know for what. We lay on the sand, rolling over, shoving each other, pretending to be mummies like the people down the beach. We had fun playing, then went swimming again. In the evening, the Sadatore family had dinner in the kitchen and invited Nella and me to join them. It was a wonderful evening. Lydia never mentioned the neighborhood, but once her first impulse of hostility had passed, she asked about me. When Marisa told her that I was very studious and went to the same school as Nino, she became particularly nice.
The most congenial of all, however, was Donato Sadatore. He loaded Nella with compliments, praised my scholastic record, was extremely considerate toward Lydia, played with Ciro, the baby, wanted to clean up himself, kept me from washing the dishes. I studied him carefully, and he seemed different from the way I remembered him. He was thinner, certainly, and had grown a mustache. But apart from his looks, there was something more that I couldn't understand, and that had to do with his behavior. Maybe he seemed to be more paternal than my father, and uncommonly courteous. This sensation intensified in the next 2 days. Sadatore, when we went to the beach, wouldn't allow Lydia or us two girls to carry anything. He loaded himself up with the umbrella, the bags with towels and food for lunch. On the way, and equally on the way back, when the road was all uphill, he gave the bundles to us only when Ciro whined and insisted on being carried. He had a lean body, without much hair. He wore a bathing suit of an indefinable color, not a fabric. It seemed a light wool. He swam a lot, but didn't go far out. He wanted to show me and Marisa how to swim freestyle. His daughter swam like him, with the same very careful, slow arm strokes, and I immediately began to imitate them. He expressed himself more in Italian than in dialect, and tended somewhat insistently, especially with me, to come out with convoluted sentences and unusual phrasings. He summoned us cheerfully, me, Lydia, Marisa, to run back and forth on the beach with him to tone our muscles. And meanwhile, he made us laugh with funny faces, little cries, comical walks. When he swam with his wife, they stayed together, floating. They talked in low voices and often laughed. The day he left, I was sorry as Marisa was sorry, as Lydia was sorry, as Nella was sorry. The house, though it echoed with our voices, seemed silent. A tomb. The only consolation was that finally Nino would arrive.
32.
I tried to suggest to Marisa that we should go and wait for him at the port, but she refused. She said her brother didn't deserve that attention. Nino arrived in the evening. Tall, thin, in a blue shirt, dark pants and sandals, with a bag over his shoulder. He showed not the least emotion at finding me in Ischia, in that house. So I thought that in Naples they must have a telephone, that Marisa had found a way of warning him. At dinner, he spoke in monosyllables, and he didn't appear at breakfast. He woke up late. We went late to the beach, and he carried little or nothing. He dove in immediately, decisively, and swam out to sea effortlessly, without the ostentatious virtuosity of his father. He disappeared. I was afraid he had drowned, but neither Marisa nor Lydia was worried. He reappeared almost 2 hours later and began reading, smoking one cigarette after another. He read for the entire day without saying a word to us, arranging the cigarette butts in the sand in a row, two by two. I also started reading, refusing the invitation of Marisa to walk along the shore. At dinner, he ate in a hurry and went out. I cleared. I washed the dishes, thinking of him. I made my bed in the kitchen and started reading again, waiting for him to come back. I read until one, then fell asleep with the light on and the book open on my chest. In the morning I woke up with the light off and the book closed. I thought it must have been him and felt a flare of love in my veins that I had never experienced before. In a few days things improved. I realized that every so often he would look at me and then turn away. I asked him what he was reading. I told him what I was reading. We talked about our reading, annoying Marisa. At first, he seemed to listen attentively. Then, just like Leela, he started talking and went on, increasingly under the spell of his own arguments. Since I wanted him to be aware of my intelligence, I endeavored to interrupt him, to say what I thought, but it was difficult. He seemed content with my presence only if I was silently listening, which I quickly resigned myself to doing. Besides, he said things that I could never have thought, or at least said, with the same assurance, and he said them in a strong, engaging Italian. Marisa sometimes threw balls of sand at us, and sometimes burst in, shouting, "Stop it! Who cares about this Dostoevsky? Who gives a damn about the Karamazovs?" Then Nino abruptly broke off and walked along the shore, head lowered, until he became a tiny speck. I spent some time with Marisa talking about her boyfriend, who couldn't come to see her, which made her cry. Meanwhile, I felt better and better. I couldn't believe that life could be like this. Maybe, I thought, the girls of Via dei Mille, the one dressed all in green, for example, had a life like this. Every 3 or 4 days, Donato Saratore returned, but stayed at most for 24 hours, then left. He said that all he could think of was the 13th of August, when he would settle in Barano for 2 full weeks. As soon as his father appeared, Nino became a shadow. He ate, disappeared, reappeared late at night, and didn't say a single word. He listened to him with a compliant sort of half-smile, and whatever his father uttered, he gave no sign of agreement, but neither did he oppose it. The only time he said something definite and explicit was when Donato mentioned the longed-for 13th of August. Then, a moment later, he reminded his mother not Donato, that right after the mid-August holiday, he had to return to Naples. Because he had arranged with some school friends to meet, they planned to get together in a country house in the Avellinese and begin their summer homework. "It's a lie," Marisa whispered to me.
He has no homework. But his mother praised him, and even his father. In fact, Donato started off right away on one of his favorite topics. Nino was fortunate to be able to study.